Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Ray, and welcome to the RayWenderlich.com podcast. In this podcast, we'll keep you up to date with the latest app development tech talk. Now, here are your hosts, Mick and Jake.
Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Mick Pringle, and welcome back to the official RayWenderlich.com podcast. I'm joined, as usual, by my co-host, Jake Gunderson, and today we're going to be talking about Core Data with Sol Mora, engineer at Coursera and co-author of Core Data by Tutorials. Welcome, Sol. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for inviting me. It's good to be here to chat about Core Data.
Cool. I mean, before we get into that, could you tell us a little bit about who you are and how you got into iOS development?
Oh, man. Yeah, so I'm Sol Mora, and like you said, I'm an engineer here at Coursera. And I got into iOS development, back before it was iOS. It was actually iPhone OS. I went to WWDC 09. Back when it sold out in about 30 days instead of 30 seconds, and just kind of went there on a whim. You know, the iPhone was brand new, and I was like, well, I should look into this thing, and just bought a ticket, went, everything went over my head, but just kind of got, got the bug, and everything kind of started from there. From there, I went to conferences, and then learned more stuff, got work, went to more conferences, started talking at conferences, started the podcast. There's a whole lot of stuff that kind of originated from my first WWDC. So I kind of credit that particular event to kind of where I am today.
Fantastic. Now, I've heard Core Data be referred to as many things, you know, like a database or an ORM, etc. And in your book, you specifically describe Core Data as an object graph management and persistence framework. So I'm hoping for anyone who has perhaps felt Core Data a bit unapproachable due to not quite understanding what it is or what it's for, if you could explain what exactly that means.
Yeah, so that whole term of object graph persistence framework is kind of a lot of it's a mouthful for sure. But if you think about it, when you write applications and you write basically non-persisted objects, just regular old Ponzos, plain old NS objects, right? So you write that and you write all of your application logic in these model objects. You know, if you're following the model view controller paradigm, you have your business data in those model objects, and in that case, non-persisted, and you put them there anyway, right? So the only difference to think about really is that rather than just letting them only live in memory and vaporize when you turn off the app, you can actually persist these things to some kind of persistence mechanism. Now, most people treat Core Data as kind of their SQLite wrapper, but the truth is you can you can use whatever persistence mechanism is handy. If you really wanted to go with XML, you could do that. There's a custom binary store that's available, and some of these options are only available on the Mac. But the actual implementation detail of the persistence format is actually left as a separate thing from the actual object graph. So I think that separation really trips up a lot of people.
Okay, and since it obviously deals with persistence, which, you know, like you say, keeps your state across launches, my next question was going to be when should it be used, but it sounds like, you know, any app that needs to retain state across launch should be looking at, you know, Core Data.
Right, so the rule of thumb I generally give people is that if you need to search, sort, or filter your data in any way across launches, then you should use Core Data. But I use it basically in every app, and I use it as kind of the heart of my app. When we talk about like business objects, you know, in kind of this enterprisey term, or basically, you know, all the entities and the objects that represent the object model of the problem you're trying to solve there, they will eventually need to be persisted. So you can have Core Data behave the way normal Ponzos work, because you can have an in-memory store and have them, you know, just disappear at the end of an app run. But it's so much nicer to be able to just say, well, this time I want those things to actually save to disk. So I would say you could use it in every application that you write, and certainly it would be kind of something that permeates throughout your app. So, you know, you probably would not get rid of it. And I've seen a lot of people actually try to isolate core data, like isolate the fact that they are using core data by having objects that maybe conform to a protocol that so that they can just, use that protocol in their views or view controllers or such and not really rely on the fact that they're core data objects. And that's okay, but I don't think you need that level of craziness, but sometimes, yeah.
I know that there's some alternatives to core data. One I'm familiar with is FMDB, which is a much thinner wrapper around SQLite. I've also heard of a new one called Realm that seems to be getting a lot of attention lately. Can you speak to some of the benefits and if there's other alternatives you're familiar with? And kind of when is core data the right choice and when would you use something else?
Yeah, so FMDB has been around for a long time back in those iPhone OS days, back before we had core data on the iPhone and iOS in particular in general there. So FMDB is basically a SQLite wrapper, and you basically have to know that SQLite is the storage mechanism if you're using FMDB. And that might be okay. If your data should be modeled in tables and rows and that's exactly what your app needs, that's a perfectly fine solution. I think FMDB is still, I won't say it's maintained, but I think the community helps kind of keep things up to date a little bit. There are, you know, you mentioned Realm, and Realm is kind of the new hotness these days. There's been a lot of hype around Realm. A lot of people have been talking about it, especially here at Coursera. We're trying to investigate, you know, other ways to persist data beyond core data. And, you know, one of the things I've noticed about Realm, which is rather interesting, well, first of all, it looks a lot like core data in the way that you have these Realm objects that kind of hold on to your objects. So it seems like these objects live in a realm and you kind of save stuff that way. So in a lot of ways, that seems like the whole NSManage object context thing that permeates core data and also trips up a lot of people, especially new people. But what's interesting about Realm and what actually will help us here is that there is no schema per se. There is no schema file. So in core data, we have this NSManage object model that defines the objects, the entities, the relationships, the attributes, validations, all the things that we need in our data model for it to work. So basically, we have this file that defines the schema so that core data knows what or how the store looks, right? But with Realm, you actually don't have to define that file. It actually just reads the Realm objects that you create, the subclasses of RLM object, and kind of creates that data model on the fly. You know, that has some benefits, and I'm sure it has some drawbacks. I haven't really investigated it much further, but that to me is like the biggest difference that actually has us looking at it as a use for our particular scenarios here at Coursera.
That makes sense. I know for me, when I first started out with iOS, I had come from a place where I had written a lot of SQL queries. And so I leaned towards using FMDB in some of my earlier apps. And what I found was that as I got into it, like it was great for me to have the familiarity and the comfort with SQL. And so FMDB worked for me. And core data, when I was brand new, there's so many just setting up a core data just like the basic core data structure, there's a lot of objects and it's confusing because you're like, why are there so many different objects to do something, which in your head at the time is simple. It's much less simple than you think it is because of the relationship between the persistence part of it and the object graph part of it. But as a beginner, you don't care about that distinction, right? But anyway, as I got into FMDB, I realized, okay, now I need a mechanism to, you know, fetch a subset of data to put in a table view. Now I need a mechanism to do maybe undo or whatever. And the more I used FMDB, the more I realized, oh, this already exists in core data. If I just kind of bit the bullet and learned core data in the first place, I ultimately probably would have saved myself some time. Obviously, that's not going to be true for everybody, but I do see that sometimes where developers avoid core data because they're like, well, I get how SQL works, and so that's comfortable for me. And then, right, and then so, down the road.
Yeah, so I've heard that before, and kind of one of the things to think about is that core data is All the stuff that you would write to kind of ignore the fact that there's a database under the covers, right? So it really does a good job of abstracting out those storage details and really keeping your app focused on objects and only objects. And that's the thing to keep in mind. When you're doing something with SQLite or FMDB, you're kind of doing this mental conversion, or even in just code, you're directly converting tables and rows to objects and properties, right? So Core Data kind of handles all that stuff. And also, Core Data handles all the memory management stuff for you and migrations and all this other stuff that, that Core Data does for you. It's basically the framework that you would write once you get beyond, like you said, you realize, once you realize the limitations, I guess, of something like an FMDP and just a database or a table and column model of persistence.
So let's talk a little bit about iOS 8. Are there any significant or dramatic changes in iOS 8 with Core Data besides the Swift part of it? We'll talk about Swift in a minute.
Yeah, we'll talk about Swift later. But so significant and yes, dramatic, maybe not. You know, the first, I guess, significant feature update to the Core Data is the whole batch updating feature. So this I commonly refer to as the Brent Simmons feature. So way back in the day, Brent Simmons, he wrote NetNewsWire for Mac, and he eventually ported it to iOS. And he was using Core Data initially, and then found that, you know, this one use case where he was trying to update 1,000 objects at once was really slow for him using Core Data. Whereas if he, and it also took a lot of code, and you're loading all these things into memory, and there's a lot of problems with it for that one particular scenario that Brent was encountering. And his solution was to rip out Core Data and use FMDB and SQLite directly, so he could just do a single update statement to set that one bit. So this feature in Core Data now addresses this one problem and lets you do batch updates and all that. So it's a nice feature when you need it. I would probably not use it very often. What does happen as a kind of a byproduct is that you actually kind of bypass all of the Core Data goodness that you get at the higher level. So basically what this batch update lets you do is, you know, set one bit at a lower database level, but, you know, you bypass any validation checks, you bypass any of the other relationship management things, delete rules, all that stuff, you're bypassing all of it. And Core Data just kind of lets you, gives you a nice little way to do that when you need it. But don't use it that often.
Just on that one thing, I've heard that it doesn't update necessarily the objects in memory. Is that right? Like it just goes right to the database.
Right. It just goes right to the store. So you also don't get notifications or any KVO updates as well. So when you do batch update, you have to manually reload and refresh those objects in memory. So again, this is not something that you're going to use all the time, but it is that feature that's now nice to have. And if you need it, it's there. So it wasn't there at all before.
And is that sort of automatically handed off to a background thread? Or is it still you have to pass it whatever context you want it to run on?
Sorry, what was the question?
Well, because obviously if you're batch updating, like it's going to tend to be, you know, several objects being updated at once rather than just one. I was just wondering if, because I know a lot of people have issues with multi-thread access and things like that, if it's automatically handed off to a background thread to be run, or do you still have to manage that?
So I don't think it's not automatically run in a background thread as far as I know. I think you'd have to do that on your own. And there is actually a couple of new APIs for that. So you know how we have perform block on the manage object context? There is also perform block on the coordinator object as well. So that's a little bit different. And I think that is what you might be using to kind of do this batch update on a background thread.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So as far as the other feature that is probably relevant to most listeners is asynchronous fetching. Asynchronous fetching in the past was pretty hard to do. You would probably have to use something like a GCD queue, and you'd kind of load up some stuff in the background with separate context and all this craziness. You'd have to do all kinds of stuff to get that to even be remotely background-ish. And then you'd have to kind of get that data and merge it back onto the main thread if that's where you're fetching it to. But now you've got asynchronous fetching where things will kind of be handled for you, and you can just kind of load a mountain of content from your core database into your result set there, and it does it asynchronously. So that's those are the two big heavy hitters that we got in core data this year.
I mean, that asynchronous fetching sounds like a pretty big deal, because I know, that's always been one of the problems that I've run into when using core data, is trying to do anything asynchronously and setting up background queues and, context restricted those background queues and trying to manage the parent-child relationships between those contexts and getting everything in sync and keeping it in sync. So, I mean, that sounds like it's a pretty, a pretty big step forward.
It is. And, the thing that I took away from WWDC this year from the core data talk is that the core data team is trying to really help everybody manage the threading a lot better. One of the big concerns with core data in the past that I've heard is that it's the threading, the multi-threading story is pretty bad. But I think it really came down to is that people, developers in general, are just bad at multi-threading. They just don't know it yet. And then they blamed core data. So the core data team has tried to, learn from this, feedback that they get, and make these multi-threaded APIs and making multi-threaded access to their data a lot safer.
So on the threading issue, I know in the past that the recommendation was to, and this is some of what confuses me with core data still, it used to be that you wanted to create a different managed object context for each thread or something like that, and then the parent-child API came along, and does that replace? And then we've also got a block-based API. Can you kind of speak to when you'd use which one of those? Do some of them replace the others, or you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so we're kind of in a weird period with that particular API. So again, at this past year's WWDC, they kind of mentioned that the confinement context, which is the context that you're talking about, is the one that we would do on every thread, and that is actually going to be deprecated eventually. They didn't say next year or this year or whatever. They said probably it will be deprecated, so probably stop using it, which is kind of a big hint that says you either should use all of your data access on the private queue context or the main queue context, and basically let core data handle all that stuff. So for now, if you are doing stuff on one background thread, and you use a single context and do all your stuff on that context and save it through that context, you'll be fine for now. But just kind of be aware that that's actually going to update, and eventually could be deprecated. So I think Apple in general will give us a little bit of at least notice when that happens. So it's not going to happen overnight, though.
Just before we move on from any changes that came as part of iOS 8, I know one of the features that sort of a lot of app developers complained about when it was first introduced, I think it was introduced in iOS 6, was iCloud Sync. And I know when iOS 7 came around, they sort of made some promises that certain things had been fixed, but developers were still having problems with it. And I was wondering if that was something else that had been addressed in iOS 8. Is that something you got experience with?
So, and I think most of those problems had been fixed in iOS 7. So, I actually wrote the chapter for iCloud. I only wrote two chapters in our Core Data by Tutorials book, and one of them was the iCloud chapter. And yeah, prior to then, iCloud had been horribly horrendous to sync data. You know, you would get it to work magically by using some of the sample code that Apple had released to create that fallback local store and do all that madness to get it, to get it to sync into that store only, and you know all that setup that was really hard to do. And you know, we'd obviously get it wrong, but once you magically got it to work, then eventually it would stop syncing because like the transaction logs were unable to merge across the iCloud and things like that. And then basically you have, you know, a data store that could not sync across iCloud. Now in iOS 7, and it's kind of also carries forward in iOS 8, the Core Data team has taken the responsibility of, you know, controlling and maintaining that fallback store for you. So they've removed a lot of code that you have to write. So basically, all you need to do is basically flip a switch with your iCloud permissions in the entitlement section of your app. Set a couple of keys in your options dictionary. And voila, you've got an iCloud-enabled app. It's actually fairly simple, and it actually does work. I have not experienced problems with iCloud sync myself using Core Data iCloud syncing. But yeah, it's come a long way. It's, for one, it's a lot easier to set up. It's also interesting to note that the Core Data team has provided ways to debug the iCloud problems, in that we have this iCloud debug inspector guy in Xcode. So if you fire up an app that has iCloud enabled, you'll see this kind of moving graph of all the data that's coming to and from iCloud through your app. And you know, it'll have the locations of all your fallback stores in your app. So you can kind of see what's going on under the covers just by enabling iCloud and letting Xcode do its thing.
Great. I mean, it sounds like that they have fixed a lot of what developers were complaining about. So, you know, if anybody listening had tried and failed miserably with iCloud sync, then perhaps, you know, post iOS 8, it's worth revisiting by the sounds of it.
It's safe to get back in the water.
And also, you touched on it there, so I thought it'd be a nice segue. Core Data by Tutorials. Did you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so this is a book by me and three other co-authors, Pietro and Aaron and Matt. And the book is really kind of somewhat of a soup to nuts walkthrough of Core Data, and we had started the book prior to this year's WWDC when we got Swift handed to us, and at DubDub we decided to switch it all to Swift. So at least it's Swiftified, so it should be good to go for that. But Core Data itself hasn't changed so much, so it was really just trying to make sure that we could get those ideas across in the language that people are really excited about. So there's that. But it's also kind of a soup to nuts walkthrough of Core Data from the very beginnings of setting up, you know, those initial bits of Core Data, the context, the coordinator, the model, and things like that, and getting that going to some more of the more advanced features like, you know, multi-threading. We also walk through the iCloud setup, like I said, and versioning and migrations, which I'll have to say that I have not seen any other books on Core Data, and I've read quite a few that kind of go through the detail of, like, at least the versioning and migration piece that we do, because most people really just walk through an example of, you know, the lightweight migrations. And there is so much more to migrations that are so helpful in other scenarios that we've decided to kind of take that on and add that to the book. And I think that that's one of the chapters that I wrote as well. And I think that really does a good job of explaining what migrations are, how they work, and it walks you through with a lot of the code there to kind of get you from through three or four different versions of a migration, which can be pretty hairy.
I mean that really sort of piques my interest, that the migration stuff, because I recently was working on an app in my day job, and we had to perform a migration, and I'd never done one on Core Data before, and this app's got quite a large user base, and trying to find, I mean, the Apple dot stuff on migration is like you're tearing your hair out reading through that stuff. and I was just like stumbling across like the odd Stack Overflow answer, or you know, somebody had written a blog post which kind of almost got you some way there, but didn't quite get there. It was a little bit outdated. So to be able to have a reference to go to that's like up to date, you know, that's something that I'm really happy about. I mean, I've been quite excited about this book once I learned about it. Anyway, I was talking to Ray about it before we started recording, because the last core data book I've got was the Marcus Zahra one, which I don't think has been updated at least recently, and a lot of it's more desktop focused, and obviously it's in Objective-C. So to have this brand new book come out covering all this stuff that you know, interests me, and for it to be written in Swift, you know, I think that's a great thing.
Yeah, so to be fair to the Marcus's book, I think he does have a second edition that does have some iOS references and stuff in there as well. So he has updated a second edition, but yeah, you know, the first edition is very desktop focused because he wrote it back when, you know, there was, you know, there was no iPhone, I think. But yeah, this, you know, the whole migration story, I mean, people don't realize just how powerful Core Data is just through migrations alone. You can go from this lightweight migration where it does everything for you and does a lot of stuff in place to having full control over the order of the models and data that you version, to actually transforming the data yourself, to, you know, doing just really crazy stuff with migrations that you never imagine possible. You know, one of the migrations that I've done actually for a client before I started working at Coursera was to take one model and actually, or one store, and actually split it up into several different stores based on the data that was in there. So we actually created, we took that an original store file and said, well, you know, we have this project object that was in this one kind of giant store. It's like, well, we need these things to be separate because, you know, they're separate projects. So we just did that in a migration, and that's totally doable with Core Data. And I don't even know how you would do that in SQLite. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff that Core Data can do, and hopefully we cover at least the nuts and bolts of how to get started with that in the Core Data by Tutorials book.
I have another question about migration. I was actually listening to a podcast, and it came up that sometimes when you do a migration, it can load the entire Core Data store into memory, and the iPhone can have issues with that being limited memory. Do you have an experience with that, or have you seen that, or is that an older problem that's been solved that I just don't know the solution to?
So if you do a lightweight migration, it actually does not load the entire thing into memory. It will just do everything against the store on disk. So a lightweight migration will say, a lightweight migration means you don't have to provide a mapping model, so you don't have to define how data goes from one store to the next and such, or one version to the next. So what it'll do is basically create a bunch of, you know, alter table, alter column statements, if you're familiar with SQL, and it'll just do that under the covers. And it won't load anything into memory other than, you know, the migration manager and a few things like that. But when you go into something more complex, and we talk about these in the book, you know, when you go into the manual migrations and a lot more custom stuff where you're doing custom data transformations, those have to go into memory. And you can... I think the migration manager tries to handle that memory management for you. You have to kind of let it do its thing. And you know, it could be that if you're running into memory issues, that might be something to bring up with the Core Data team and a radar. But yeah, it's only when you're going to deal with those really heavyweight custom migrations that you're going to have a problem with that, if at all. So,
good to know. Thank you. So let's talk a little bit about your framework, Magical Record. You wrote, this is a wrapper around Core Data. Is that the right way to describe it?
Yeah. So, you know, Magical Record was kind of inspired by my work on Ruby on Rails back in the day. I had just gotten my first, iOS job, and it had Core Data all over it. And I could not understand what the heck was going on in any of that code. So I was like, well, I think you can do it like this, or wouldn't it be nice if we could do things more this way? And then I could understand stuff. So it just kind of came out of necessity, and then I open sourced it and blogged about it, and people have started to like it. But yeah, it's kind of a wrapper. It's a lightweight wrapper, although it's gotten pretty heavy these days. It has a lot of cool stuff in it. But yeah, it's just a nice way to... kind of put all of your core data accessors into a single line. It's really trying to eliminate the boilerplate code to get data out of core data and make sure that, you know, you're focusing on the task at hand, which is in a lot of cases just querying the data. So it does that. It does actually a few other things, which I really enjoy. One of my favorite features of Magical Record is actually the import library. And what you do there is you have a lot of times with web APIs, you have JSON data, or maybe you have some kind of object model externally that you want to traverse. And what you want to do is kind of import that and persist that into core data. You want to have that locally available, just on the fly. Right. So what you want to do is import that data. And so what you can do is you have basically your source data, and you tell core data, here's the entity that I'm going to import all this data into, and let it go. And what it will do is assume that the data matches one to one and just kind of import it directly. Now, that obviously is not the common scenario. You're always going to have deviations. So what I've done is in your mapping model, there's for every entity and for every attribute, you have something called a user info dictionary. And what I've done there is let you populate those user info dictionaries with your mapping and conversion rules and things. So it's a really nice way to do data imports basically by convention and configuration. So it's one of my favorite features, just because it does all of that heavy lifting for you, and all you really care about is this data maps to that entity in core data, and it just goes.
And if people want to take a closer look at Magical Record, where can they find that, Sol?
You can find it on GitHub. You can search for Magical Record there, but you can also go to magicalrecord.com. It will point you to the repo there. So I've made it really easy for people.
Fantastic. And I think that's probably a good place to wrap things up. So thanks again, Sol, for coming on.
Sure, no problem. Thanks for having me.
And guys, be sure to check out Sol's own podcast, NS Brief, a link for which we'll make sure is in the show notes. And that's it for another episode. As always, if you've got any questions or feedback, then please don't hesitate to get in touch via podcast@raywendellick.com. And if you do enjoy these episodes, please make sure to leave a review on iTunes. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you all next time.
And that's a wrap. Thanks again, everybody, for listening to the RayWendelick.com podcast. We hope you enjoyed it, and don't forget to leave a rating on iTunes. See you next time.